Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Rainforests have long been recognized as hotspots of biodiversity, but they are crucial for our planet in other surprising ways. As these lungs, carbon sinks, and climate moderators of our planet continue to be destroyed, it is critical to reverse the decades of rainforest depredation if life on this planet as we know it is to survive. Today we talk with Tony Juniper, author of Rainforest, Dispatches from the Earth's Most Vital Front Lines, which draws on the author's decades of work in rainforest conservation and breaks down the latest science on how rainforests support civilization. Tony, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Well, it's great to be back again.
Yes, it's been a while. And I was thinking about the title of the last book that we talked about, which is about 6 years ago, which is basically, what does nature have to offer us? Or what's the good of nature? You know, kind of that attitude. And I think that you could call your rainforest book maybe the same thing. Like, well, what use are rainforests to us? And I think maybe a lot more people are aware of that now than they were maybe 6 or 10 years ago. So what really inspired me in reading your book was actually learning just the mechanics and science of how rainforests, how they kind of come to be and how they thrive and how they support life on Earth. So I thought we can start with that and then we'll get into why rainforests are so important and why we should care about them. So first of all, what makes a rainforest a rainforest?
Well, the first chapter is entitled A Clue in the Name. And that clue in the name is the rain part, because these ecosystems, as everybody might imagine, are very wet. But they're not only wet because of the rain that falls upon them, they're very wet because of the moisture they put into the atmosphere. And so underneath the trillions of leaves that are growing in the rainforest on the trees and the shrubs and the vines, underneath those leaves are little tiny microscopic pores which enable the plants to breathe and to take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and to put out oxygen as a byproduct. But as well as releasing oxygen from the bottom of those leaves, the trees are pumping vast quantities of water vapor into the air. So if you imagine the rain falling down into the forest, it's not simply flowing along the rivers, it's also flowing back up through the plants and into the atmosphere to emerge as a gas, as water vapor. And that vapor on the moist, warm, tropical air rises upwards as the sun's energy drives air currents towards the sky. And if you can imagine that water vapor going up towards higher altitudes, it begins to cool down. And as it begins to cool down, so it condenses into microscopic water droplets. So it's going from a gas vapor back into a liquid in these tiny water droplets. And these has the effect to create a vacuum, because when the water vapor is in a gas, it occupies more of the air than when it's condensed back into tiny water droplets. And so that vacuum, if you can imagine the air collapsing in on itself as this condensation is taking place, then it's pulling up air from beneath where the air pressure is highest. And so you get these colossal forces, these incredible updrafts driving the clouds up to very high altitude. And additionally to the condensation going on because of change in temperature, it's also being catalyzed by tiny particles in the atmosphere. People may have heard of cloud seeding, putting tiny particles into the air to cause clouds to make rain. In this case, the tiny particles are coming from the pollen grains on the numberless trillions of flowers that are growing in the forest, and also microscopic spores from fungi, those fungi that are so important for how the forest works. In this case, also important for helping to condense moisture. And as these colossal updrafts go to the sky, then when they get to a certain altitude, it's driving lateral air circulation. So the air, you can imagine, running horizontally once it reaches a certain altitude, because there's nowhere else for it to go. And so not only is the forest pumping up some 20 billion tons of moisture in the case of the Amazon rainforest every day, but it's also driving regional air currents at a much greater scale, and in the process helping to move some of that water very long distances. So during the course of researching rainforest, I happened to visit South Dakota in the United States, where I met farmers there who told me about the extent to which their crop yields depend upon reliable rainfall. And as I was speaking to them, I had in my mind the conversations I'd had with American scientists who'd pointed out to me how some of the water reaching the Great Plains of North America actually has its origins in Central and South America, with these great pumps of forests moving this moisture over very long distances. And so once you understand that set of connections, and obviously it becomes a question of not only are the forests important for where they stand in terms of the rainfall and the hydrology that they're driving, but also much further afield, far south in South America at the latitude of Sao Paulo, one of the most important grain-growing areas of our planet, right the way through to North America, and indeed some of that moisture probably traveling across to South Africa as well. So that, once you start to look at these connections of water, gives you just some sense of how fundamental these systems are for the whole planet.
Well, what makes why are there rainforests in parts of the world and not in others? What are the conditions that are required to have a rainforest, whether it's the Amazon rainforest or even the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest rainforest here where we're broadcasting from?
Yes. Well, it's moisture in the end, it's water. And in the case of the temperate rainforests of North America, this is water being drawn off of the Pacific Ocean. In the case of the Amazon rainforest, not only is that pump of moisture helping to drive air currents that are going north and south, it's also pulling in moisture off of the Atlantic Ocean. And you find that those coastal forests in South America are then driving moist air right into the interior of South America, as far west as the Andes Mountains. And other areas of rainforest across the world similarly are located in those very equatorial regions. And it's interesting that the subtropical deserts lie either side of these systems. And so in Africa, you have the Sahara to the north, and then to the south, there's the Kalahari Desert lying either side of these areas of very dense, very wet forest. And this is really a reflection of how the moisture pulled in from the ocean, but as the air is going upwards on that biological pump I described a moment ago, when the air reaches very high altitude, it's dry because the moisture has fallen back down as rain or has traveled very far on the long-distance air currents, meaning that you have dry air descending either side of the tropical rainforest, meaning you have these subtropical deserts. And so these systems are all related to one another, but the driving force behind the tropical rainforest in that very intense solar radiation that comes down in that area around the equator is really the driving force. It's very intense sunshine driving this hydrology, this water movement that really makes these places function as they do. And of course, the more we degrade them, the more they become fragmented, then the greater the danger that they cease to function as they presently do.
Well, one more thing about just the creation of rainforests that kind of I puzzle about. Why is it that the Atlantic Ocean helps to generate rainforests in the tropics, but not in northeast North America, the Maritimes and New England, or in England, for that matter. Whereas the Pacific, which is the same latitude as the northern areas of Europe and north and east, the east coast of America, do have rainforests that go all the way up to Alaska.
Well, we used to have rainforests here in Britain along the western side, as you have along the western side of North America. We don't really have any fragments at all left, unlike what you have in the western side of the US and Canada. But the difference is that in those regions where you have the western-facing coasts, is that they're receiving rain from depressions, from frontal rainfall coming in as part of the way in which the atmosphere works in those higher latitudes. Whereas in the tropics, you've got the moisture in large part being pulled off of the ocean by the forest itself because of this very high level of energy that's being converted from sunshine into vegetation in this process of photosynthesis, then driving that biological pump I mentioned just a moment ago. And in this part of the world, certainly this time of the year where I'm sitting in England, we don't have a lot of plant activity, so there's no biological pump as there would be in the tropics where the sun is shining all year round. So it's the chemistry and physics of the atmosphere. It's the physics of the atmosphere which is really different in these latitudes compared to what's going on in the tropics. tropics where there's more sunshine. And the other thing to bear in mind about the tropics, of course, is that in the case of the Atlantic, adjacent to the coast of South America, that also is receiving a lot of sunshine, therefore evaporating more moisture into the air, which can then be pulled in by the forests.
Well, another interesting thing that I was really piqued by in your book was the whole concept of cloud forests. I didn't even know what a cloud forest was until I traveled to Venezuela about 15 years ago and was in the Andes and actually took a teleférico up through the cloud forest. But I didn't really even understand what a cloud forest meant, except there were a lot of orchids weaving out of the trees, until I read your book. So talk about cloud forests and how are they distinguished from rainforests?
Right. So the cloud forests are different again. And so these forests in the tropics, a tropical cloud forest, you generally find above about 1,000 meters above sea level, so just over 3,000 feet or similar. And these forests, obviously, on mountains, they're much cooler. And at those altitudes, not only are they receiving rain, but many of them are also intercepting clouds, hence the name. And so if you travel, as you have by the sound of it, to the mountains in Venezuela or into Central America or in parts of East Africa and parts of Southeast Asia, Vietnam, for example, you find mountains at those altitudes clothed with very dense, moist forest that most days, every day in some cases, is receiving very thick cloud coming in to the forest altitude. And as that goes into the forest and mingles with the vegetation, so you get condensation coming off of the many surfaces that are on the trees and the other plants that are growing on them. So not only do you have trees with very dense foliage, you have ferns, you have mosses, you have lichens, and indeed the epiphytes, including in the tropical South America, bromeliads, and in other parts of the world, orchids. And all of these plants present a very high surface area of material upon which the cloud can start to condense. And so some of these forests, even though it's not raining inside them, if you go and stand in one of those places, it is as if it's raining with the moisture just falling off of the trees. And in fact, there's one very large tree I found in a Costa Rican cloud forest, which on a day when it wasn't raining, but it was very cloudy, the forest was generating its own little stream of water with the moisture flowing down the trunk as a result of this effect of intercepting the cloud and condensing it and turning those water droplets back into flowing liquid. And so these places are incredibly important for biodiversity. Up those cooler altitudes, different species exist, and some of them live in only very small parts of the world where the conditions are just right. And that in itself, obviously, is hugely important in so many ways. But the reason the cloud forests are very important is because in some parts of the world, drier parts of the tropics, where you have these rainforests, these cloud forests at higher altitude, they actually enable the rivers to flow even when it's not raining during the dry season, because the cloud is still coming in. It's not producing rain, but the rivers have water in them because of these forests having this effect, moisture out of the atmosphere in that way. So they are incredible ecosystems and incredibly rich in their biological wealth as well.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFD LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Tony Juniper, who's author of Rainforest, Dispatches from the Earth's Most Vital Frontlines. Another thing that's really fascinating to me in the way that you describe in your book is the network underground that connects all the trees and the way that they communicate with each other. And I was, in fact, having a conversation with several friends about this very subject in the last few days. So if they're tuning in, maybe you could explain how the trees talk to each other.
Well, this is a remarkable piece of emerging science that is still work in progress, but nonetheless, who are looking at forest ecology have discovered how the trees don't simply grow in isolation, but are being connected underground via threads of fungal connection. And so these fungal threads are called mycorrhizae, and they're a way in which the trees and the forest coexist, with the fungi releasing nutrients into the ground which are then available to the plant's roots to enable them to grow. And in return, the plants are providing sugars into the ground to effectively feed the fungi. A very close symbiotic relationship where both parties are getting some benefit. But the incredible thing, which goes even a step further than that close partnership between the fungi and the trees, is the extent to which these fungal threads appear to be able to transfer messages between individual trees using chemistry in order that, for example, one tree that's being attacked by a particular pest, maybe a beetle infestation with the larvae eating the leaves of the tree, that tree that's being attacked can send a signal via the mycorrhizae to neighboring trees, and those neighboring trees can then raise chemical defense cells to help reduce the impact of the pest attack upon them. And this is something which, you know, is obviously quite surprising to understand once we know these kinds of things, but just as one more confirmation of just how intricately interconnected these systems are, with every component in the forest relying on other components and not simply being a collection of trees. It's an incredibly rich web of life, which is self-sustaining, even though it's changing over time. It's self-sustaining, with every part playing its part in keeping the whole system running. And that, I think, is one of the most exciting areas of recent research into forest ecology, is understanding that relationship between the soil organisms and the trees that are growing above.
Well, back in the 70s, science fiction writer Ursula Le Guin wrote a book called The Word for World is Forest. And basically, it was a description of this world that had been discovered by Earthlings, in which it was actually one living being. And I guess that concept would also be like the Gaia concept. I find it interesting. Ursula Le Guin was thinking about that back like in 1978. How closely do you think her vision of the word for world as forest really relates to what we're beginning to find out about the way forests actually interact and survive?
Well, I think we're hopefully beginning to understand the ultimate set of interdependencies and connections that enable our planet to work as it does. And of course, it's not only forests that are important in terms of how our planet functions, but also deserts, oceans, the tundra regions, the mountains, the way in which nutrients are recycling between all of these different things in different ways, connecting even the driest and the wettest systems on Earth. And one example of that I describe in the book is how the nutrient balance in the Amazon, which is on a knife edge in terms of that lush growth being very much based upon scarce nutrients, and how those nutrients are being topped up by dust blowing across from the Sahara Desert. So in that case, it's a forest which is an incredibly rich and diverse system, but which is in part dependent upon another system which is extremely dry, and indeed on the other side of a massive ocean, on the other side of the Atlantic. And so the more one looks into how these different elements of the system work, the more certainly I'm inclined to consider it being a single entity and functioning as something within which, you know, the parts are inseparable to one another. And removing forests probably is one of the most unwise things that a so-called intelligent species like humans could do.
Well, and also we'll add another creature to this web, and that's the salmon, who are responsible for the incredible, massive rainforests of the Northwest, and actually not even just of the rainforest, but forests that go all the way into Idaho and Montana, because the salmon who travel up these salmon streams die and decompose, and their bodies get carried around by bears and eagles.
Yes.
How do you see that connection? I'm wondering if there's any animal forms in tropical rainforests that serve the same function that salmon serve here in the Northwest.
Well, the relationship between the animals and the rest of the forest in the tropics is incredibly intricate, as you can imagine. And two of the ways in which I describe the interdependencies between different bits of the vegetation and the animals that live there is via the process of pollination on the one side. And then once trees and plants have managed to pollinate their flowers, and the production of seeds that follows, and how those seeds are moved around the forest by different animals. And so the pollination is being undertaken by a multitude of different creatures, literally hundreds of thousands of species of insects, many birds, some mammals, including monkeys and bats, that are important for pollen transfer between flowers, enabling them to reproduce. And then when those flowers do reproduce in the form of a fruit or a nut, then the animals, again, being vital for moving those seeds to other parts of the forest. And some of these relationships are very specific indeed. So, for example, some species of orchid that are growing in the forest, they have only one species of insects that will pollinate their particular flower. And so the relationship between the two has evolved in a very close way, to the point where neither can do without the other. And then one wonders why there would be such specific relationships. And part of this seems to be down to the extent to which in the tropical rainforest, where there is such intense activity and there are diseases, there are pests, there are creatures wishing to predate other creatures, living at low density can sometimes be a good survival strategy, so that if you are a particular kind of tree which is fed upon by a particular kind of insect that would damage your leaves, or if you're invaded by a particular bacteria that would cause you to die, then separating yourself from other members of your species actually may not be a bad idea. And so to that extent, long distance seed transfer, including very big seeds that can travel in the gut of an animal like a forest elephant, or seeds that can travel in the gut of a bird like a hornbill over very long distances, this actually is quite a smart survival strategy, and so appears to be a reflection of the diversity in the forest, is this attempt to stay one step ahead of diseases and pest attack, and having these dispersal strategies as part of that. And of course, the more you begin to remove some of these seed dispersers or pollinators, the more you imperil the whole system, and indeed, the more you start to change the fundamentals of the whole system. And one of the things that we're all very worried about in the world today, quite rightly, is climate change. And one of the things we should bear in mind as we're trying to fight that particular problem is the extent to which forests hold more carbon when they have that full complement of animals in them. Because if you remove things like forest elephant, after a while, you're going to remove the trees that rely on those animals to move their seeds. They won't be able to reproduce, and when they die out, it will start to change the carbon content of the forest. And indeed, some scientists have begun to model this and discovered that over time, if you move those big seed dispersers in the future, the forest will be able to hold less carbon than it presently does. So all of these things point in one direction, really, and that's about not only protecting the forest cover, but also protecting the animals that live within them. And in some parts of the world, in parts of Asia and parts of Africa, there is now a phenomenon called empty forest syndrome. And this particular phenomenon is down to the effects of hunting and people taking out the animals. And you may get a satellite picture of a forest showing that it's still there, but inside that forest, it may be functioning very differently to how it should be as a result of those mammals being removed by people hunting them for food, or indeed hunting them for souvenirs or trophies.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of our general understanding of the dangers to tropical rainforests around the world has to do with deforestation. But let's start with that, and then let's talk about this whole interconnected web that you're describing. Let's talk about first what we all know about rainforests, that they're being cut down, and what are the driving forces for cutting down the rainforests?
Well, I think in the end, it's two things. One is to get hold of natural resources, and so that is including things like logs of timber and minerals from mining operations to get at the minerals beneath the forest. And then there is what is increasingly a bigger factor in the early part of the 21st century, which is the conversion of the forests for agriculture, different kinds of farming. And so at the moment we have witnessed, I don't know if you've had this, I'm sure you have, in U.S. media coverage of the big fires raging in the Amazon this year, which have basically been down to the conversion of forest to cattle pasture and also opening up new land for the production of soya beans. with those soya beans being largely destined to feed animals in cages. So factory farming of cattle, pigs and chickens to be putting into the human food chain. And then alongside that very large-scale agriculture in some parts of the world, there is a problem with people having no land upon which to feed themselves and their families. And when you're in poverty, one of the things you can do is open up land that appears to be vacant, including forest areas that you can convert into gardens to grow some food. And of course, that particular problem increases as you have bigger and bigger rural populations in different parts of the world who are very poor and don't have any alternative but to encroach on the remaining forest areas. That's particularly the case in parts of Africa. So the food system really is where we need to focus in many ways. But the good news is that to feed ourselves, including a rising human population globally, we don't need to cut down any more forest. And indeed, if we do wish to feed ourselves in the decades ahead, we might want to start putting back quite a lot of the forest that's already gone, considering how it's so important for the water cycle, which of course is vital for agriculture. And of course, in order to catch carbon and to keep that locked out of the atmosphere in ways that will also protect the future of farming, because farming is probably the most vulnerable sector globally in our economy to the effects of climate change. And in some parts of the world, of course, we're already seeing that. So it's not a question of whether we have to have forest or whether we have to have food. The truth is we have to do both. And the truth is that we can do both and indeed considerably expand the forest cover in the process. And I write about some of this in Rainforest, including the example of Costa Rica, which has managed to increase its food exports over recent decades, at the same time as increasing its forest cover, as well as increasing the per capita wealth of its citizens. So it's not a question of whether it's possible. It's a question of whether we have the will to do things in that way. And then that's obviously then a complicated political discussion about who's got power and how they use it. And the example of what's happened in Brazil over recent months shows you the big difference that politics makes, with President Bolsonaro making remarkable and fairy tale claims about the extent to which converting the Amazon is going to contribute to the development and the economy of Brazil. It will have quite the opposite effect, not least because Brazil not only relies massively on agriculture for its exports, which are dependent on rain, and that rain comes from the rainforest. Not only that, but 80% of Brazil's electricity is coming from hydroelectric dams on rivers. And what, of course, is topping up those rivers? Well, of course, it's rain. And the more the rainforest is disturbed and degraded, then the more imperiled will become the viability of Brazil's hydroelectric power sector. And indeed, in 2014, and I write about this, I was at the time, there was an epic drought in the south of Brazil, which was linked to deforestation, and which not only caused impacts on the Brazilian economy, its manufacturing and its agriculture, but also caused blackouts and the cutting off of the country's power supply. And so how anyone possibly think that you have to convert the forest in order to contribute to Brazilian development, I'm afraid it's a myth of epic proportions.
Well, unfortunately, it's a myth that's being spread around the world. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today with Tony Juniper, author of Rainforest Dispatches from Earth's Most Vital Frontlines. When you finished your book, which I'm assuming was several months ago, you were kind of borderline optimistic about maybe some turnarounds, like what you're just describing about ways that we can reforest. But I've thought a lot as I was reading your book in the last few weeks. Well, what are you thinking now with Bolsonaro? You've sort of described it to a bit, who has been so extreme in his denial of reality, basically. And then we have, you know, up north here in the United States, Donald Trump and his coterie who just deny facts. And the same thing is true of Putin, and the same thing is true of Xi in China. And I mean, one of the things that I'm actually really concerned about is not just what's going on in the countries where the rainforests are, but foreign powers, in particular China and the United States, who are complicit, if not maybe aggressive, in really destroying these ecosystems for their own national, basically, I think their military strategic motivations as well as economic motivations.
Yes, well, one looks at all of the facts, and never mind the facts, also the personalities. It's very easy to become quite downcast and gloomy about all of the prospects for this. But I do think that is a mistake in terms of how we go forward, because at the end, I think we're only going to be able to make progress in halt and then reversing this trend of forest loss if we can paint a positive picture of what the goals could entail. And so that's why in the book I do focus, you're quite right, on quite optimistic examples of where things have gone well, because I think that's very inspiring for people in being able to see the upsides of this project of forest conservation and reforestation, at the same time as being able to dispel the mythologies that are put out there. Because as you're describing, you know, many leaders, they might give us the impression that there is no alternative except to continue with environmentally destructive ways of being. If we can paint a picture of actually why that is not the case and showcase those examples of where things are being done in a good way, I think that is actually a very powerful means of shifting the discussion in a good direction. And I think what's going on at the moment, certainly in this country and probably in the United States, is that there is this very strong upwelling of public concern about global warming, about deforestation, about the loss of biodiversity. And I think probably the most effective way of channeling that public concern towards some good outcomes is to let everybody know that it doesn't have to be like this, and that we do have better alternatives that we could put in place if only we had the leadership to do that. So I am deliberately an optimist on all of this in order to be able to channel the concern and to be able to deal with this idea that actually the inevitability of all of this is very clear, and there's no alternative but to continue in the way that we have been. I don't think that's right. Well, it certainly isn't right. But I think by showing people that, you know, things can be done differently and people can have jobs and they can have good incomes and your economy can be strong, then I think that's really the best way of just proving the point in the face of the kind of rhetoric you get from Donald Trump and President Bolsonaro, amongst others.
Well, how do we get that leadership? I'm thinking about here in the Northwest. One of our local struggles is really trying to stop these mega frack gas projects from being built in Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, right.
And so here we are fighting these frack gas projects, which of course do enormous damage in terms of climate change and will affect the rainforests around the world. And on the other hand, it'd be really nice if we were working on building up our own forests and taking out more dams, and then we could focus on that as opposed to just this resistance we're doing. And we can't even get our climate champion governor to, you know, to come out against this massive LNG export terminal that a Canadian company is trying to build in south on the southern Oregon coast. So how do we get leadership? I mean, let alone having someone like Trump or Bolsonaro in power, but even Democrats in this country and the liberals you have in England to take a stand that really makes a difference.
Yeah, I think this is there's a number of things that contribute to the better direction of travel. So number one is public understanding of the issues, and so your program and many others like it around the world are vital in being able to equip people with the basic knowledge that we need to be able to ask for different choices from our politicians. The other thing we have to do, I think, is to build coalitions for change that take people with us. And I have to say, as a long-serving environmentalist, that sometimes, you know, we environmental advocates, we haven't done great in being able to paint a picture of what good looks like for people who are not us, if you see what I mean. And I can't help thinking that President Trump did very well in the 2016 election because he spotted quite correctly that some people were being alienated by the environmental message. So Detroit auto workers, West Virginia coal miners, Pennsylvania steel workers, amongst others, really didn't want to believe the reality of climate change. And so they were ready to believe somebody who told them it wasn't true, because that was an attractive message. Now, if we could, by contrast, not only talk about the perils of global warming, but also bring people with us in founding new industries, new jobs, new things that will bring pride to communities, different technologies, all of the things that we know could work, then I think we might have a better chance of being able to turn the corner. Because the politicians who are putting in place the new fracking infrastructure, maybe even opening coal mines in different parts of the world, they know that people will support that because it looks like it's going to be bringing jobs, it's going to be bringing economic development, and therefore is something that communities would by and large welcome and would be willing to believe the climate change denial in order to get those jobs, if you see my drift of thinking here. So in the European part of the world, we talk a lot about just transition. As we go from high carbon to low carbon, what's going to be the pathway that's going to look attractive to people who've got jobs in high carbon industries? What does the people working in Boeing think? What do the people working in Ford think in terms of how the technologies that they provide for the world can be done better in the future? And so building coalitions with people designing new technologies and being able to work with them and the labor unions and the communities that feel threatened by action on climate change, I think actually is also a vital part of the equation. And we are beginning to make some progress in this country, I think. The point I raised about public awareness, it is pretty high here now. And as a result of that, leaders from across the political spectrum speak with pretty similar views about what needs to be done on climate change. And all the main parties now have a so-called net zero policy, which is very encouraging. And one of the things which is enabling this to happen is that we are beginning to make a transition. So along the east coast of England, there are some very deprived communities there. But some of them are now beginning to see the benefits coming in the wake of multi-billion pound investments in the offshore wind industry, including in parts of the country where there used to be a lot of coal mining along the coast of Yorkshire. The coal mining was further away. But nonetheless, that region of England now is seeing the transition away from high carbon towards low carbon. And for some people, at least, it's bringing jobs and benefits to communities. And so I do think there is an element of that which environmental advocates need to keep in mind. Because if we can't bring everybody with us, or many people with us, then in a democracy, which is all about majorities, then we're probably not going to have enough support to be able to do what we need to do. And, you know, as the days go by, we need to do it more urgently than ever. And indeed, the World Meteorological Organization today published new figures showing how the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere are now higher than any point for at least 3 million years. And that's going to lead to quite big changes in our world. But we don't have time really now to be working only in opposition as environmental campaigners. I think we do have to be finding ways of bringing everybody else with us as best we can, at least.
Well, actually, I think the Green New Deal here in this country that is being proposed by progressive Democrats and other people is exactly the same thing. It's being
It's exactly that.
It's interesting how mainstream conservative environmentalists go, well, it's not about the environment. How can you talk about jobs and all this stuff when we have to talk about the environment? But in fact, I think there's more and more voices that are expressing that this is, it's all about everything.
Yes.
And that's very hopeful. Also, just as an aside, in Coos Bay in Southern Oregon, where they want to build this massive LNG export terminal, there are also plans moving ahead to build an offshore wind farm. And this is would really, as you're describing, in the south of England, would really be a great boon for this community, which is basically a fishing community and used to be a logging and log export community, and the trees are gone. So I think that people are looking at this, and it's a way of just having to shift priorities so people aren't still looking at these old solutions that don't work anymore.
No, that's right. And the more examples we have of how things can be different, the more convincing it becomes. So hopefully we're beginning to move in that more positive direction.
Well, one of the places where it seems things can make a difference, and I'm seeing it here in this country as well as in the rainforest world, is following the leadership of Indigenous people. So let's talk about what role they have, and why is it that Indigenous people maybe know better than the rest of us how to really preserve the rainforest and by extension preserve the planet?
Well, yes, I do write in Rainforest about the role of Indigenous people and relate the story of one tribal group in Peru in particular, the Ashaninka, but they're by no means unique in making some broader points about the importance of that kind of community and that kind of social group having control over the decisions that affect the forest. And I think in the end, the reason for this is pretty simple. If you look at most Western approaches towards the tropical forests, then we see value very often through our corporations and our financial institutions in the forest when it's destroyed. So the logs have value, the minerals have value, the beef has value, the palm oil has value, the soya beans has value in the market. You can make a profit with it. Whereas for the indigenous people who live in the forest, their entire world is predicated on that forest continuing to exist. They get their food, their livelihoods, their religious beliefs are all based around the forest as a healthy, intact entity. So their worldview is completely different to most of the worldviews of the people who are cutting these places down or setting them on fire. And so the more that it will be possible to create control over the forests by communities of people who have that philosophical approach towards the future of these ecosystems, then that's got to be for the better. You know, that's a very general point, and there are many complexities to all of this. But where the indigenous people do get control of the forest, then by and large, that leads to the forest being kept intact rather than converted to other uses. And indeed, look at maps of the Brazilian Amazon, parts of the forested terrain of Colombia and also in Peru. And those places where the indigenous people have control of the forest is where the forest still is. And so we have good reason to believe that this actually is quite an effective strategy. And of course, there are NGO groups that are devoted to empowering indigenous groups for this very reason. Not without its controversy, not without political tension, of course, because in countries like Brazil, where you have some level of indigenous control, of course, you have people who want to open iron ore mines and to be expanding cattle pasture. So it's not necessarily something that ultimately solves all of the problems. But if we do want to hang on to large areas of remaining forest, then equipping the indigenous people with the means to do it is a very good strategy.
Well, actually, I'm concerned, like in Brazil, Bolsonaro's actual stated policy is to take indigenous land. So how can that be countered?
Yes. Well, I think for the situation in Brazil, I think there's two things. And so one I already touched upon, which is to point out and to point to the evidence, which shows how for Brazil, never mind the rest of the world, for Brazil, that country gets more value out of the Amazon rainforest when it's intact rather than when it's been damaged or degraded. And so we have good evidence around that, particularly in relation to water, which is the lifeblood of that country's economy and indeed every other country's economy. The second bit, I would say, in terms of what we could do, is to be mobilizing public opinion in different parts of the world, to be encouraging major brands who buy Brazilian produce, whether it's leather or beef or soya or whatever it is, to be insisting on deforestation-free supplies. And so this has actually been quite a powerful way of achieving influence in the past, with Greenpeace, amongst others, doing a fantastic campaign about 12 years ago to achieve a moratorium on soya plantations going into forest through doing a global consumer campaign, in that case working what proved to be in partnership with McDonald's, who to begin with were the target of the campaign, but then who joined in with Greenpeace to try and find solutions. So I think all those huge big brands who buy produce, which is finishing up in consumer goods, if we tell them all as customers on social media, in the store, write them a letter to the chief executive, we wish to have zero deforestation products, please. That makes a difference. And I think in the case of what's going on in Brazil at the moment, quite a few corporations are thinking that. They really don't want to have their products tainted by deforestation. If you're a burger chain, for example, and you've got burning rainforest linked to your brand, that's really not good for business. And if we as consumers go out and say, can we have high standards, please, then many companies will respond positively. And as they do, it sends a powerful economic signal to the Brazilian government that actually, you know, the world is not looking for you to trash this forest to produce cheap products, what we'd like you to do is look after it for the benefit of everybody, including your own country.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KWU Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Tony Juniper, who's author of Rainforest, Dispatches from the Earth's Most Vital Front Lines. I want to return to something you were talking about in the beginning of the show, which is it's not just about protecting trees from being cut down, but it's also protecting the animals who actually help to regenerate the trees. And so I wanted to find out what is happening now to find alternatives for people living in the bush or close to the bush who are either dependent on bush food, as I call it, bush meat, to survive, or who are lured by the high amounts of money they can get from other markets for this meat.
Yeah, so this is all about, I think, about providing people with some alternative to what seems like, you know, the only thing you can do if you've got nothing to eat and there's meat in the forest, and if you've got no money but there's value in the timber, then finding alternatives to those kinds of social dilemmas really is very important. I write in the book about some attempts being made in West Africa by companies who are in the chocolate business. And so in this case, in the book, I'm writing about a project being done by Mondelez, who are responsible for some of the world's biggest chocolate brands, Toblerone, Cadbury Dairy Milk, Hershey's, I believe, as well. And they're procuring their cocoa from very poor communities living at the edge of the last remaining areas of tropical rainforest in some of the world's poorest countries. And what they're trying to do is to stop deforestation through social programs that are trying to find ways of giving the people a bigger income, and that is in large part through helping them increase their yield of cocoa and through investing in social programs that the people can benefit from, including education and basic literacy. And one of the reasons why companies are doing this is because of the first thing we spoke about a little while ago, which is water. And so the fragmentation of the forests in that part of the world is leading to more erratic rainfall, including long droughts. And drought is really not a good thing for cocoa. It requires very moist conditions and ideally would be close to areas of healthy forest producing rain. And so this is why, one reason why, not the only reason, why some companies now are beginning to put two and two together and to see that social programs that help people to have a better living in ways that are going to help to protect the forest is not only something which is good to do from the point of view of our values for our society, but actually is also a business strategy that in the future will reduce the risk of climate-related impacts on the basic commodity that they need in order to be able to make a profit. Because if you can't get cocoa, you can't make Toblerone. And if you can't make Toblerone, then you can't go to the stock market and seek investment and run a global brand. And you can't do any of these things unless there is a social sustainability at the level of the farming communities who are doing this. Because if they're cutting down the forest, in the end, they're going to be removing the wealth, i.e. the rainfall, that enables this whole industry to exist. So there are some examples of companies trying to put two and two together and invest in different kinds of business models on the ground rather than just taking the commodity as cheaply as they can get it and walking away and hoping to come back next year and do the same. They're beginning to realize that you have to be there for the long haul and to be taking a broad view about how all of these things work. And if you don't do that, then in the long term, it's quite obvious that if you're in a food-related company, especially one that relies on tropical commodities like cocoa, then you're potentially into quite a risky business. So it does make business sense increasingly to do this, but we need more of it. And of course, not only from the companies that are buying those kinds of commodities, but also from governments and them to be investing properly in the future of their people with those kinds of social investments. And actually in Costa Rica, another country that's written about in the book, I describe a similar situation whereby the forest conservation has gone hand in hand with government-backed efforts to improve health and education. And, you know, it's not complicated, the set of connections. If you give people decent health and education, they've got a much better chance in life and will be less needing to take desperate measures involving the hunting of wild animals or cutting down the last bits of forest that they happen to live next to.
Well, one of the...
Yeah, but...
Go on, I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking that one of the controversies that comes up in the environmental movement is if you talk about the need to do what we need to do environmentally for the sake of the earth, that you, if the debate is whether you talk about it just in terms of what's the right thing to do versus what is pragmatic, what's going to get big business, what, you know, the other motives that you're talking about. And I'm wondering, how do you reconcile these two threads of thought? How do we convince people who are maybe a little bit more purist about, like, just you have to do this thing because it's the right thing to do, to understand that we need to have a multiplicity of steps to understand how do we get to actually do the right thing?
Well, I think both are essential, actually, and both sets of voices have been hugely important in terms of how they've coexisted over the decades, bringing the environmental stories to public attention and then having people who can actually do something in the complicated situations that inevitably exist beyond the headlines and the slogans. And so purity is a great thing to have for campaigning, but isn't necessarily a very good thing to have when you're trying to put real solutions into effect on the ground. Certainly, we have to have values. Certainly, we have to have high ethical standards. But inevitably, in any of these conversations, one finishes up having to negotiate with all sorts of different organizations and different entities and different interest groups, to the point where, and I would say, you know, this is a very clear conclusion of mine, it's not going to be possible to solve these environmental problems unless we invest in real partnerships, partnerships between companies, communities, governments, scientists, and the NGOs that are moving some of these issues forward. So we're going to have to do that. And at the same time, that doesn't detract, I would say, from the importance of having very strong, clear-sighted messages coming from about the need for urgent action and the way in which the action should be couched, which is obviously to do it for the right reasons. But what might be the right reasons for campaigners, you might have to have a different set of reasons that point in the same direction for other people. And actually, those cocoa companies is a very good example. Yes, of course, they shouldn't be in an industry which is linked with deforestation. And yes, of course, they should be doing more to help the local people. But if they can do that as a result of finding out that their entire industry is at risk from deforestation because of the effect on the rainfall, then I think that's okay. I think it's okay for environmentalists to do that. I don't think it necessarily detracts from what we're trying to do in the wider sense.
Well, Tony, I want to thank you very much for all the work you've been doing over all these years to protect the rainforests and the rest of the earth. And also, thanks very much for this book. I think it's a really good introduction as well as an in-depth look at why rainforest is so important to the planet. So thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I hope a few readers enjoy looking at the book.
I hope so, too. And I look forward to your next book and have you on again.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Sure. We've been talking today with Tony Juniper, who's author of Rainforest, Dispatches from the Earth's Most Vital Front Lines, and you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you'd like to catch the show later on today or tell your friends or family about it, you can hear it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any other KBOO public affairs programming, go to KBOO FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we're going to be talking about birds for a change with Bob Salinger, who's with the Audubon Society of Portland. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Alhassi Baikota, who's from Gambia in West Africa. Thanks for listening. Manzola baro de baila.